This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Jeff Foyer of the National Lawyers Guild will talk to us about subway searches.
Since when does taking the underground allow you to have a general search done of your entire body?
We'll preview a new site, Tracked in America, which chronicles the history of surveillance of individuals based on race, religion, ethnicity, and political belief.
You'll hear the incredible, sad history of what America has done to its own.
Al McCoy will join us to talk about his book, A Question of Torture.
If you think what happened to the people at Guantanamo is something different, read Al McCoy's book and see what the United States has been doing for scores of years.
All that and more today on Law and Disorder.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Where you been?
Nice to see you.
I know. I've been gone. I've been traveling a whole lot.
Where you been?
Well, a lot of different places, but I want to tell you about the most exciting to me was traveling through the UK on a Taser's tour. A lot of interesting stuff going on there. Went to Northern Ireland because they're actually considering outfitting police officers there with taser weapons to use on the public.
Now, everybody here knows what taser weapons are, don't they?
Yes.
What are they,
Donna? Taser weapons are the electronic rifle that shoots 50,000 volts of electricity into the human body, and many police officers in the United States are armed with this weapon.
It does it with a dart, right?
Yeah, well,
it's connected with
the... Yes, there are the typical taser that everyone knows about is it looks like a gun, and what it does is it shoots two darts that are like fish hooks at about 123 miles an hour into the human body. They can penetrate a couple inches of clothing, and they penetrate the skin. Once these hooks are attached to your body, it completes a circle that creates a circuit. And at the press of a trigger, a police officer can shoot 50,000 volts of electricity into the human body. And what that does is it immediately disrupts your entire system, and most people collapse to the ground immediately and become disabled.
If they're lucky, I mean, it could kill them.
Unfortunately, some people die. You know, other people suffer. You know, a police chief in Missouri was doing a demonstration for his squad, and he was showing all of his officers that how Taser works and how it's really harmless. So he hooked himself up to an electronic heart monitor, and then he shot himself with a Taser, and he suffered a heart attack. My colleagues at Amnesty International in Northern Ireland and Scotland asked me to come out to talk to various people about tasers. And it was really instructive to go there because it really highlighted two things. One, the increasing power of this corporation, Taser International, and their global span, and how they want to put tasers into the hands of police officers all around the world. Northern Ireland, as you all know, for example, has an incredibly politically sensitive police situation. They don't arm their police officers with guns other than for personal protection, so they're not authorized to use them on the general public, like we are police officers are here in America. To arm them with tasers with a country with that kind of history of torture and policing is a very scary thing. We had a series of appointments with everyone from the different political parties across the spectrum to the policing board to police officers themselves, to the human rights commissioner who works for the policing board. Now, that was a stunning, stunning moment for me, because not only do they have a human rights commissioner that works and is part of the police system there, but this commissioner is not a joke, and the police actually take him seriously. So, for example, last year he made 60 recommendations, and they adopted 59 of them. And they're good recommendations. And so we had a great meeting with him, explaining to him what the taser experience has been in the United States, and that a lot of police officers here really love them, but we're also seeing police officers here who are suing Taser International, saying, look, we got misinformation, people died on us, we didn't expect this to happen. And we know that when police officers are pulling their tasers and using them on the general public, their intent is not to kill, but often people end up dead, and we need to really have adequate, independent, comprehensive medical testing on this weapon before we know if it can be used and how it can be used and in what context. In the States, we have guns. And so a lot of people say, isn't it preferable to use a taser instead of a gun? And that's really just a false choice out there. We shouldn't be putting any kind of weapon into the hands of the public.
Dahlia, now, is Taser International marketing that very quality, that these are safer than weapons? So, because it seems such a stretch to go from officers who don't carry weapons to go to tasers.
Well, you know what's really interesting is that when we looked at the marketing Taser International is doing in the UK and the marketing that they're doing here in the United States, they're telling the public and police officers two very separate things. I mean, they even have different kinds of information on their websites. Their UK website is different from their US website. We did a ton of press, which was really great. And I was invited to address the Scottish Parliament, and we talked about what the true impact of tasers really is and the questions that are out there. And it was a very fair discussion. And so, we'll see what happens. But we had the police ombudsman in Northern Ireland, after we had a meeting with her and then an extensive panel with her, came out, changed her position, and she came out against tasers for police.
It's remarkable in a place like Scotland, where they don't use guns, that it's a serious escalation. I mean, to go to tasers, and then, I mean, you can just know that the next step is going to be guns.
If they don't use guns, what do they need tasers for?
Yeah.
Well, what do they need anything for?
They hadn't had a death in the UK up until now. And when I was visiting, people kept saying, well, there hasn't been a death here, there hasn't been a death here. And my response was, look, if you're using tasers, unfortunately, it seems to be only a matter of time. And sure enough, when I came home in my inbox, there it was, the story of the first man, a father of, I think, three, who died after being shot by a taser. Both United States law and international law assert that our fundamental rights are guaranteed without exemption or distinction as to race, ethnicity, sex, language, religion, or political expression. Despite this, the U.S. government has a very long history of unjustly targeting and harassing and persecuting people on the basis of their race, ethnicity, religion, or beliefs. Amnesty International is proud to support this project called Tracked in America, Stories from the History of U.S. Government Surveillance. And it gives you a very good sense of surveillance throughout U.S. history. It starts a little bit before World War I, goes through World War II, the Red Scares of the McCarthy era, the Civil Rights Movement, protests against the Vietnam War, the Sanctuary Movement of the 1980s, and what we speak about here every week with you on Law and Disorder, the current post 9/11 era. I think you'll find it fascinating. You can go to amnestyusa.org/US or lawanddisorder.org to listen and see these people firsthand. Now, we want to talk about one person in particular whose story featured in Tracked in America is really touching and speaks volumes about the post 9/11 era surveillance and the clampdown on dissent. Eric Shaw. He grew up believing in American principles, supposed principles of freedom and civil liberties for all, and he joined the U.S. Marines to foster those ideals at home and abroad, but when he returned to civilian life 3 years later, he lost all respect for the U.S. government during the buildup to the most recent invasion of Iraq. So he started organizing anti-war demonstrations, and he found the surveillance incredibly intimidating. He was stunned when riot police shot at him and other peaceful protesters in Oakland, California. But to this day, despite this clampdown on dissent and personal attack on him, he's refused to be silenced. We're going to talk to him in a few minutes, and you're going to listen to, you can listen to his story on our website, lawanddisorder.org, or amnestyusa.org/US. Welcome, Eric Shaw, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for having me.
Eric, please tell us a little bit about why you got involved in the anti-war movement.
Well, the reason I got involved in the anti-war movement is because I'm really a child of the civil rights movement. I grew up in the household of a former Black Panther. My mother was in the Black Panther Party. And I was raised with the ideas that we have to protect our freedoms. We have to stand up for the rights of free speech, free assembly, you know, all of our constitutional God-given rights as Americans. And so I ended up joining the Marine Corps back in 1990 with the belief that I was actually going to be joining an organization where I would have the opportunity to defend those rights for my family and for the people that I cared about. But when I was sent over for the first Gulf War, I became disillusioned because I realized that as a Marine, I didn't even have the rights that I was supposed to be fighting for. The reasons we were sent over weren't for the proliferation of democracy or the expansion of civil liberties to oppress people throughout the world. And when I came home, I began to see that the attack of September 11th, which was a horrible atrocity that happened to the American people, was being used as fuel to support the Bush administration's agenda. And that agenda was the appropriation of the Iraqi oil wealth and to take over and occupy that sovereign country. I saw that also the other Marines that were a lot like myself, 19-year-old kids that didn't know any better, were going to be sent over to lay down their lives.
So, Eric, what did you start doing when you came to these conclusions?
I got frustrated because I told myself that I can't let this happen to other Marines. I can't let this happen to other young boys that are being asked to go over there for the wrong reasons. I can't let them give their lives for the corporate dollars, basically, or for the profits of Halliburton and Chevron Texaco. I can't let it happen to somebody else. So I began to stand up and attend protests, and I went out with an organization called Direct Action to Stop the War, where we actually shut down the city of San Francisco for 3 days.
Just before the war or once the war had commenced?
This was once the war started. This was on March 20 of 2003, once the bombs started falling on Iraq. The people of San Francisco Bay Area came out in full force and shut down the city in protest of the war. We decided that we were also going to continue that same spirit of peaceful protest and take it to the port of Oakland, in Oakland, California, where two shipping companies, Stephen Doering Shipping Lines and APL, American President's Lines, were actually profiting from the war. We decided to draw attention to them as people who were supporting the campaigns of people that were going to be pushing us and drawing us into these conflicts so that they could profit from it. So when we got there, the Oakland police were already in riot gear. They were already determined we would not be allowed to exercise our rights. And I'm thinking that, wait a minute, this is what I joined the Marine Corps for, is to defend the rights of everyday Americans, everyday citizens, to stand up and speak out, have a voice of opposition or dissent when we feel that our administration is failing us, to be able to hold them accountable. And here was Oakland Police Department saying that we weren't going to be allowed to express that right. This was in April 7th of 2003.
And you were already out of the Marines at this point.
Yes, I was.
Okay. But so when you got to the site of the protest had not yet commenced.
Right.
And there were already police dressed in riot gear?
when we got to the site where the protesters were going to be, one of my jobs was I was giving people an orientation explaining that this was a peaceful protest, that this was a community picket with singing and chanting and walking around with picket signs. But the Oakland Police Department were in full riot gear, told us that they had no intention whatsoever of letting us expressing that First Amendment right.
Did you have a permit to demonstrate? Are we on the sidewalk? I mean, why do you think they were in riot gear, and what happened when you got there?
I think that they were in riot gear because they had no intention of allowing us to demonstrate.
Well, tell us, Eric, from your perspective,
Yes. What
happened? You got there, you were giving instructions to everyone on what was going to happen during this peaceful protest, and what happened?
And almost immediately, Oakland Police began to attack us. They used a line of police motorcycles to push people. We were confused because we were never given an order to disperse or one that we could hear. We were never even told the path that they wanted us to follow in order to disperse. We were trying to comply, but they began to fire on us with what they call these less lethal weapons, these 1-inch diameter, 2-inch long wooden dowels, fired out of shotguns. In many cases, in most cases, fired directly at protesters.
So it's like a wooden bullet?
These were wooden bullets. They also used rubber concussion grenades.
What is that?
They're these grenades that, when they explode, hundreds of rubber pellets disperse in all directions. The way they're supposed to be used, they're supposed to be thrown in the middle of a crowd at their feet, and the pellets would hit people at their legs, but the police officers were throwing these things high in the air, so when they did detonate, they detonated at head level, and they were hitting people in the face. The ricochet rounds, these wooden dowels, are supposed to be fired at the ground so they would ricochet up, and they were used really in maximum security prisons for riot control, not for crowd dispersal.
How many people were in the crowd there, and how many people are injured, and what did you do about it?
There were about 500 people in the crowd at the time when it was clear that they wanted us to disperse. Most of the crowd tried to run, even though we tried to keep them calm. There were about 200 or so of us caught and unable to disperse, and 35 of us were injured.
How were you injured?
I was shot in the back of my leg. Most people that were shot were shot in the back as they were trying to comply or trying to leave.
With these wooden pellets, right?
With these wooden dowels.
Wooden bullets.
What kind of injury did that result in?
For me, I had a laceration and a bruise on my calf, the back of my leg. My good friend Willa Rosenthal ended up having several different surgeries to remove necrotic dead tissue where the wooden bullet had injured her leg below the skin and caused a lot of damage. She still doesn't have full capacity in her leg. It's really a sad case because in the case of Willa Rosenthal, because of everything she's been through, she cannot go to protest. She can't bring herself to do it. And this is exactly what they wanted.
How about you?
For me, before protest, I have a high level of anxiety and I'm not able to sleep. I have cold sweats in the middle of the night. And a lot of us, a lot of the 35 that were injured have exactly the same symptoms. And from my military experience, I realize and recognize this is a post-traumatic stress disorder, but none of us are receiving treatment for that. For me, I feel that I have to fight through the anxiety and go to the protest, because if we don't stand up for our rights, we're going to lose them.
Eric, we're going to share a little bit with our listeners from the audio that you have on the Tracked in America site.
When the war started in Iraq, we held large demonstrations in San Francisco and effectively shut down the financial district for 3 days. And we would see officers taking a picture and videotaping us everywhere we went. They were on buildings with telephoto lenses, taking pictures of us. In April, we're going to do the same thing at the port of Oakland, where two companies stood to gain a lot by us being at war, and therefore contributed to the campaigns of people that will most likely take us to war. And I wanted to make that connection in the minds of people in America. So we decided that we were going to go to the Port of Oakland and we were going to have a community picket, the nonviolent spirit of picket. When we got to the Port of Oakland, we were met with hundreds of police officers that far outnumbered us. They were already in riot gear. They already had tear gas masks on when we arrived, which said to us that they had every intention of doing what they did next. A line of motorcycle cops broke through the line of police officers and started bumping people with their motorcycles violently. And then a line of officers with shotguns stepped up and started shooting at us. We had no idea what was being fired out of them. We had every reason to believe that it was live ammunition. They were shooting directly at the protesters. And they were throwing these things that looked like grenades above our heads. And then these things exploded. And a bunch of rubber pellets shot out from these grenades and hit people in the head, hit people in the back, hit people in the arms. We never heard a call to disperse. We never got an indication from the police officers where they wanted us to go. As I noticed that people were running in a way that contributed to their danger, I decided that I got to be calm here. I got to help other people be calm. So as I was slowly walking away, I was yelling to people, please be calm. Please walk away instead of run away. And just then I got hit in the back of the leg with something that felt like live ammunition, and it knocked me to the ground. As I'm on the ground, I'm thinking to myself, I went all the way to the Persian Gulf as a Marine to fight for these very rights that we were exercising. And I had to come all the way back home to get shot. The thing that I got shot with was what they call a ricochet round. And it's a wooden dowel that is about an inch in diameter, and it's round, and it's a solid wooden block. They were designed to be used in prisons where there's a very even floor that made of concrete, and they're supposed to be shot at the floor. But what the police officers in Oakland were doing, where they were firing directly at people, many people got seriously injured. A good friend of mine, Willa Rosenthal, has had so far $85,000 worth of surgery as a result of the impact of one of these ricochet rounds. Willa Rosenthal can't participate anymore. She can't bring herself to get past the anxiety. It's too much for her. There are others that can't go. I can't go to many of them. Every now and then I'll work up the courage and I'll go because I realize that if I don't go, that they've succeeded.
That was Eric Shaw on the Tracked in America site. To hear more from him and others like him, visit amnestyusa.org/US or lawanddisorder.org.
So what have you been doing since this protest in terms of the war and protests and yourself as well as other organizations? Have you seen the protest movement grow? Are there other soldiers involved?
One of the things that I've involved myself with is the protection of the rights of other soldiers who are deciding in larger and larger numbers that they don't want to fight in this illegal war, and they don't want to fight in order for corporate gains. So if they have to make a sacrifice, they want that sacrifice to mean something. So more and more soldiers are finding the courage to resist. There's an organization that I'm working with by the name of Courage to Resist, that are looking after the rights of soldiers who, under conscience, feel that the war is wrong and that they don't want to participate.
Eric, give us that website or the contact info for Courage to Resist.
I believe it is couragetoresist.org, but you can do a Google search and find it on the web.
Okay. Are you finding a lot of soldiers interested in this? Are a lot of people going to the site? What kind of actions are they taking?
Most. What the group is more of a resource to provide emotional support, financial support, media support for soldiers refusing to deploy. It was the same group that supported Stephen Funk when he decided not to go, when he decided on his conscience that the war was wrong.
Remind our listeners who Stephen Funk was.
Stephen Funk was a Marine that from San Jose, California, who was ordered to deploy to fight in Iraq and refused to go. Groups like Courage to Resist and GI Resistance came to his defense and supported him and brought media attention to his case. He was then court-martialed, and I believe he spent a year in military prison for standing up for his rights.
Have you noticed a growing resistance as the situation in Iraq has, certainly for the United States and a lot of other people, Iraqis, deteriorated?
The resistance is growing for a number of reasons. One is there are a lot of people deciding on conscience that war is wrong. When people are recruited, they're not really shown the realities of war and with combat and what it does to people, both in the military and civilians. Other people are finding the courage to resist because they realize that the objectives of the Bush administration aren't the ones that are being marketed to the American people. We're not fighting for democracy. We're not fighting for the rights and freedoms. We're really fighting for the agenda of the Bush administration and the neoconservatives, and we're fighting for the profit of big energy.
What can people do if they want to help?
People that want to help can write to their Congress members and senators to let them know that they oppose the war and that they want to support the troops to bring them home. People can also join the growing number of demonstrations and protests in opposition to the Bush administration's agenda and the war in Iraq. At a very minimum, people can voice their discontent and frustration with the way our country is moving, especially in the area of individual rights and freedoms. Peaceful protesters are being monitored and tracked under secret government programs. Our phone calls are being enumerated and also recorded and tracked as well. These things are in direct violation and contradiction of the Constitution
and basic human rights principles. And so we want to thank you very much for the courage that you have shown in your activism and encouraging others to get active. Eric Shaw, we're going to have your story up on lawanddisorder.org and amnestyusa.org/US, as well as the stories of over 25 other individuals who have also been tracked in America. Thank you so much, Eric Shaw.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Eric.
Thanks.
One really interesting thing that he said is that many of those who enlist in the military are lured into enlisting for this war because they're told that, you know, it's worth it to give up your life to defend your freedoms. And really, for him, the most life-threatening moment in defending freedoms came not in another country where he was sent by the Marines, but here in the United States when he tried to defend true freedom and was shot by the Oakland police.
Yeah, that Oakland demonstration is a famous one, and the pictures of the welts that people had and the injuries from those wooden dowel bullets
were horrible.
Extraordinary. You know what's amazing, of course, is Jerry Brown was governor, or was mayor of Oakland at the time. Of course, it wasn't him, it was the police chief.
Yeah.
But now Jerry is running for something again. I forgot, attorney general, and he's pro-death penalty. This is the famous Jerry Brown, who was like once one of the liberal darlings. So there you go.
That's where we are in this country. That's really where we are.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Don't know and don't wanna know. Look out, talking to the people. Yeah.
The Massachusetts MBTA recently enacted a search policy whereby transit police can search any passenger on the public transit system for any kind of device or substance that could be used as a weapon. They can use canine units, electronic scanners, and perhaps most frightening, they can do so without probable cause. In response to this new search policy, many groups in Boston have formed what they call the Safe T Coalition to educate commuters at selected subway stations about how these searches infringe on their civil liberties. The coalition hands out informational flyers and buttons saying, "I do not consent to a search." Joining us today on Law and Disorder is Jeff Foyer, co-chair of the Massachusetts chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Jeff.
Thank you, Heidi.
Jeff, I know that a couple of years ago, around the time of the Democratic National Convention in Boston, the MBTA tried to initiate a similar search policy. Is this current policy any different to that?
Yes, it is. It's a much broader search policy, and it's much broader than the one being used in New York. Under the search policy, they are looking for certainly all of the explosives and firearms and so forth that you would expect. But they've also added a catch-all, which is they can search people for any kind of device or substance that could be used as a weapon to kill or injure multiple victims on the mass transit system.
And that could encompass a wide range of implements, as we know.
You know, it could be a pen.
Right.
Because you can stab a lot of people with a pen, or it could be some liquid that you're carrying.
Starbucks coffee.
Starbucks coffee, exactly.
Now, in 2004, I know that several groups, including the National Lawyers Guild, got together, handed out buttons and leaflets, as is being done now, and the MBTA withdrew this practice.
Well, they stopped it in 2004 after the Democratic National Convention was over. So they only did it for 4 days.
And so what was the response by the public when they went on the subways and searched?
Well, there was a mixed response. There were some people who were willing to accept it, and many people who felt that this was another step toward invading people's privacy while not providing any additional security.
Jeff, let me see if I understand the policy and the differences with New York. In New York, you go up to the turnstile to get in, and before you get in, they can say, a cop can come up to you and say, "May I search your bag?" And you technically, at least, or supposedly, have a right to then walk away and not have your bag searched. Or you can have your bag searched, and then you walk onto the subway. And then, unless there's, you know, essentially reasonable suspicion or probable cause of a crime, they have to leave you alone. That's New York. We lost the case in New York, but that's New York. Now, the difference in your case is exactly what happened. Can you explain to me? I'm going into the
MBTA. Yes.
MBTA, it's right, the one that guy in the folk song went on, right?
Right, Charlie on the MBTA.
That's
now,
it. Okay.
Now I have Charlie cards here, too.
I go on, I'm going on
riding
that.
Riding forever.
Right. I'm going on that subway, sometimes on above ground. And what's the difference and what happens?
Well, there are a couple of differences. The first is that they're going to be using dogs to do sniffing of materials going on. They're also going to be using electronic scanning devices, and they're going to be doing searches.
So this is all in the before I actually put my token in, right?
Correct. Correct. This is as you're walking down into the subway entrance and before you put a token in.
And they don't need probable cause.
There is no probable cause requirement of any kind. It's going to be done, they say, on a random basis in the sense that they will pick out every fifth person, every tenth person. Who they will pick out was supposed to be a written policy in the morning. And they can change it with an hour's notice, but it also has to be in writing.
So this is real pregnant with racial profiling implications, isn't it?
Partly that, although they've taken some care to not racially profile by picking out every fifth or tenth person, but there is nothing in the written policy that says what stations they're going to do this at, and that's one of the things we're looking at.
So they could go to Roxbury or areas where there are more African Americans.
Exactly.
But also, how do you define who is the fifth or tenth person? As we all know, when you get on the subway, oftentimes there's a huge rush of people, and they'll all come in at once, at 8 o'clock in the morning and then again coming home at night, and you may have a big group. You can just pick out of five people. You can pick the one black person or the one Arab person.
So they've taken what they're doing in airports, and they've made it even worse, and they're using it now in the subway system in Boston.
Exactly. Well, wait, let me see if I still understand this. So we were at the place. You're coming in. You haven't put your token in. They have these various surveillance systems from dogs to, you know, whatever else, whatever you said, the electronic surveillance and all that.
Right.
And they have a system of either a fifth person or a tenth person, or they'll – and then when they'll pull you aside at that point if you're one of the selected people?
That's correct.
And what happens then?
And then they can inspect your handbag, your briefcase, or any other carry-on item. Not like New York, where it was limited to briefcases or packages that would be large enough to carry an explosive. Their written policy says that they can search any carry-on item.
Like a small bag with a piece of merchandise in it.
A wallet.
Now, do you have the right? Let's say you have the right when you're selected to walk away?
Yes, you do. And then you're allowed to leave, but you may not attempt to re-enter the subway station with any carry-on item.
That particular station?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, have there been any history or any documented instances where people were not allowed to leave? Or they were followed out? Or
as far as we know, no. There have been a couple of instances reported where people were actually searched once they were on the subway.
Yeah, now that I was going to get to. Okay, so let's get through the turnstile. You then go through the turnstile. What happens, I presume in New York, as I recall, that's the end. Unless there's probable cause or reasonable suspicion, you can get on the subway and ride it around.
That's correct.
Now, in Boston, what happens?
The same thing, that you can get on and ride it around once you're through the turnstile. But there are a couple of other differences that I want to point out from New York. And there was, in the New York policy, my understanding, there was a prohibition against the police going through packages and looking for books, newspapers, immigration papers, any kinds of documents. There is no such prohibition here.
Oh, that's fascinating. So it becomes essentially a general search.
That's
general
right.
Search warrant, which is interesting considering that Boston was the home of the place in which the British used general search warrants during the Revolution, and that's where part of the cause of the Revolution.
That's a good point, Michael.
So they can go through your packages, and they can take up anything, right?
They can read or inspect any written or printed materials people may have. And, again, unlike New York, they can demand personal information to have someone prove their identity or their citizenship.
So if you're an undocumented worker, and I don't know what Boston's policy is on that, but
you want to work.
At that point, they can take you in.
That's correct. We're in the process of gathering information about this, so we don't have any specifics that they have done so yet, but this has only been going on for a short period of time.
Jeff, a couple of years ago when they first started this in Boston, they said that this could be a model for a nationwide search system.
Correct.
Does that still apply?
I believe it does. I think what they've done since the DNC convention, the Democratic National Convention, is broaden their policy and make it so that they can do these general searches of people. And I think they've written a 11-page policy manual which could be used in any city. And it is also being used not only on the subway system here, but also the commuter rail system.
Jeff, in New York, coupled with these searches, they also have this loop tape that they play every like 40 seconds, warning passengers to be on guard, look around, see if anything suspicious, report it, see any packages, report it. And this like level of fear is escalated in the subway system in New York. Do you have that same kind of announcement in Boston?
Absolutely do. And that's been going on for some time. The same thing, we have the head of the MBTA announcing it. We have the head of the MBTA police announcing it. Look for suspicious packages. Look for suspicious behavior. If you see anything suspicious, report it immediately, et cetera, et cetera. And that's repeated, I'd say, probably once a minute or so.
You know, and the irony is that there have been no incidences in New York, and I don't know whether there have been any in Boston. Then they'll say, well, you see, we're keeping you safe. It's like saying, well, I keep a pound of garlic in my refrigerator, and therefore I don't have any elephants in my living room. It's maddening.
Jeff, you formed with other groups the Safe T Coalition, and T stands for the MBTA.
Correct.
In Boston. What are you doing as a coalition?
Well, the first things we're doing is an education campaign with the public. We are passing out leaflets and buttons that say, I do not consent to a search. We are getting articles in the newspaper and telling people about what their constitutional rights are and that they have a right not to be searched without cause. And we're collecting information. We're going to file Freedom of Information requests with the MBTA to see who they have been searching. They're supposed to keep records on this to see what kind of racial breakdown or age breakdown or gender breakdown there is as well. And we're considering a lawsuit.
I was going to say, particularly on the general search aspects, I think
exactly
it's pretty
exactly.
serious stuff.
Well, can you tell people who don't understand, who think that this is a pretty good idea, what is wrong with this?
Well, there are several things. One is, this is not the area that is going to increase security. It's, as everyone has said already, it's increasing fear, but not security. Instead of searching all of the containers that are coming in through our shipping ports that might need to be x-rayed, we're focusing on people who might or might not have something on the subways. Now, of course, there's not been an attack in the United States since 2001, and there's never been an attack in the U.S. in a subway system. So they're putting an enormous amount of people power and staffing and electronic stuff and dogs in here when there's not a threat that's been identified in any way. It's just to keep up the level of fear and may have people see a police presence everywhere and to get us used to that. It's, frankly, as far as I'm concerned, another step down the slope toward an authoritarian society.
But don't you think that there needs to be some kind of protections on the subway, that there needs to be something to prevent any attack from happening on the subway?
We might as well say that about any part of our society. You know, there are many, many more people killed in auto accidents every year. So should we now search everybody and stop everybody who drives?
Any place where there's a public gathering, you could say there should be this kind of surveillance. Why the subways? I mean, that's really the point.
That's right.
Happens at street corners in every place in New York City. Can you imagine? Yeah. Every club, everywhere.
Every sporting event,
right.
Every concert
exactly.
of any kind, every public gathering, certainly all the marathon races where there are 100,000 spectators, anything like that. So we might as well begin searching people all the time.
Where I think we need to get to as a society is where we realize that part of the price you pay for living in a free society is also incurring a certain amount of risk.
Jeff, exactly. Who's in the coalition with you, and how can our listeners get a hold of you?
In the coalition with us is the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts and the Arab American Anti-Defamation Committee. We are talking with, although they haven't joined the coalition yet, the T-Riders Union, and we've been talking with a number of other unions as well.
You know, Heidi asked you about other places where this kind of policy might be going on or as a model. So we know of New York, which is not obviously as nasty, and Boston. Are there other cities in the country where they do these kind of searches at all yet or anything like it?
I'm not aware of them other than going into football games. And I know that in Tampa, Florida, a judge ruled that you can't search people going into a football game solely because it is a large public gathering.
That's a nice ruling.
Mm.
How do we get a hold of you, Jeff?
Well, the National Lawyers Guild has a phone number, and we also have a website. The phone number for the Guild is 617-227-7335, or you can call the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts at 617-482-3170.
Is there information on your website about this particular issue?
Yes, there is, and on both the Guild's website and the Civil Liberties Union website.
And do you have those websites on hand?
NLG.org, and then you click on the Massachusetts chapter.
Jeff, one final question. Do you know how much this is costing the police department in Boston?
We don't, and that's part of what we're going to try and find out, because as with every other city, there are scarce resources, and to put an enormous number of police and police dogs and electronic scanners on people who are riding the subway to work every day is a waste.
Yeah, you could give people flu shots or hire some kindergarten teachers.
Basically, what this comes down to is the government asking us to give up our freedoms so that we will have security to protect our freedoms.
The sure. dogs. I'm interested
yeah.
in the dogs.
Yeah.
They're using dogs down in the stations when people come in. Is this going on?
This is part of their policy, that a police canine that has been trained in the detection of explosive materials will be assigned to do sniffs packages going in.
This is after the person's already been singled out, and then the package is put in front of the dog's snout, right?
Correct.
Jeff, we look forward to talking to you again to find out what happens with this, and thank you so much for joining us on Law & Disorder.
I'll certainly keep you informed.
We're real pleased to have Alfred W. McCoy. He's a professor at the University of Wisconsin. Professor McCoy has just written a dynamite book called A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror. Professor McCoy, some of you may remember, wrote that famous book, The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia. And he's not only a distinguished professor, but quite a brave one. It almost cost him his life researching that book. And now he's come out with an equally powerful book, I think, on the history of CIA torture. Goes back all the way 50 years. Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, these recent shameful stories that we all know about are just the most recent. It goes all the way back. That's what the book's about, and that's what we're going to talk about. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Professor McCoy.
Thank you, Michael.
Professor McCoy, this is Michael Ratner speaking, and I read your book, which I just find completely extraordinary. And one of the things that came to mind almost immediately is, you know, a lot of us who have been talking about torture, screaming about the administration doing torture, about the John Yoo memos and everything else, a lot of people think that torture by the United States is a recent phenomenon. And your book takes on that premise that torture did not just originate with the Bush administration. Can you talk to us a little bit about what are the origins, at least in the United States, in the last number of decades of torture?
Sure. For 2,000 years, torture was a part of the history and succession of Western justice from ancient Greece through the Roman Empire through medieval Europe right up into the Enlightenment, which devoted a century to its abolition. And among its signal accomplishments, of course, was then that abolition campaign was the Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which bars self-incrimination because that's what you do when you've been tortured, you self-incriminate. It wasn't actually written to protect latter-day mafia dons. It was meant to stop torture, which was synonymous with the regimes of Europe. Then all of that torture was essentially physical torture. And in the absolutist age, with things like the Iron Maiden of Nuremberg, the rack and the wheel, it achieved a kind of its technological apogee. After World War II, the Soviet Union conducted a series of show trials in Eastern Europe, and it looked like to the CIA and to the administration in Washington at the dawn of the Cold War that the Soviets had somehow cracked the code of human consciousness. At that time, our level of knowledge about cognitive science was primitive in the extreme. Suddenly, it seemed like there was this vast, limitless frontier in which the enemy had weapons and tactics and techniques in this war, of course, for the minds and of mankind that we didn't have, and we were going to lose unless we armed ourselves against them. And so the United States launched, in collaboration with the British and Canadian allies, a massive mind control project, a veritable Manhattan Project of the Mind, which ran from roughly 1950 to the early 1960s, with funding at peak up to $1 billion a year.
And wow, $1 billion a year?
For the total thing, when you add, because there were two dimensions to this. One, better techniques of mass propaganda, how to persuade whole societies, and second of all, how to break down individuals. And there were these two overlapping aspects. The whole project, $1 billion a year.
Wow.
And by mobilizing some of the most brilliant behavioral scientists of their generations and doing research at our leading universities, McGill, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, in the psychology and psychiatry departments, the CIA made a succession of breakthroughs whose sum was the discovery of a most persistent, most problematic, very distinctly American form of torture, psychological torture. And it's that form that's with us today. And it's in the technology and character of psychological torture that much of our problem lies, much of our inability to prohibit torture lies today in this society.
Now, they use those techniques. They, as I recall, and they used some of this stuff. Certainly, I'm familiar with the 80s period in Central America, but were there other periods? And then there was maybe a gap in using it? I bring our listeners up to date on that.
Sure. The way it worked was this, is that as a result of these research experiments, the CIA made three major breakthroughs. What they basically discovered was sensory disorientation. A distinguished professor at McGill University, in fact, a very famous psychologist, after whom parts of the brain are named today, terribly eminent, one of the greatest psychologists of the 20th century, Dr. Donald O'Hare. What he found was that he could induce a state of psychosis in subjects in experiments within 48 hours. And what did he do? Hypnosis, electroshock, drugs? No, none of the above. What he did was very simply, he took student volunteers and he sat them down in very comfortable cubicles and he isolated them with gloves, goggles, and earmuffs. And within 48 hours, they would develop symptoms akin to acute psychosis. The CIA was fascinated by this discovery. They sponsored research at Harvard, Princeton, Yale that tried to elaborate this into a form. And then two very distinguished neurologists at Cornell University Medical Center in New York City, who were under contract to the CIA, studied KGB torture techniques. What they found was that this KGB's most useful technique was not crude beating, but instead was simply making the victim stand for days on end as fluids flowed down to the legs swelled, suppurating sores erupted, kidneys began to shut down, hallucinations developed. And the combination of these two techniques, sensory disorientation and self-inflicted pain, drawn together, were codified in a single CIA interrogation manual, the so-called and curiously named QBARC Counterintelligence Interrogation
Manual. Say that again. What was the name?
The QBARC, K-U-B-A-R-K. By the way, listeners, if you want to read it, just go to Google and type in K-U-B-A-R-K, and you will have a PDF with an original facsimile.
Wow.
With actually the pencil edits and scribbles from whatever the source was of the manual. It's about 200 pages. But the text, although it's interesting, the key thing to do is read the footnotes, because it's in the footnotes that you can see the academic lineage, the academic genealogy of these techniques through all this university research, hundreds of projects.
This is amazing.
Millions of dollars. Anyway,
what year was that?
1963.
Okay. I want to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Professor Alfred W. McCoy. He's just published A Question of Torture. Holt put it out. It's a bombshell of a book. Professor McCoy was explaining the origins of the modern American empire's torture system.
Well, after it was codified in the QBARC manual in 1963, there was one additional experiment that answered the last question. As the CIA had the technique, what they needed to know was, now that they're going to train torturers around the globe, who can they train? The dominant idea then was that you had to be a sort of an authoritarian personality, a kind of Gestapo-like personality in order to torture. That only certain kinds of authoritarian, inherently cruel people could do this. And there was a very famous experiment conducted at Yale University by a psychologist who later moved to CUNY, City University of New York, Stanley Milgram. And under funds which I believe were routed by CIA to the National Science Foundation, and I explain my argument in that regard in the book, that with this government funding, he conducted experiments. He advertised ordinary citizens from New Haven, Connecticut, came into his Yale laboratory, and they sat themselves down in front of an electrical dial, and behind a glass was a subject who was actually an actor. And at command from a man in a white coat, the ordinary, decent citizens of New Haven would raise the dial of electric charge where the actor, the subject, would fake grunts, then screams, then horrible screams, then death. And what Milgram found was anybody could be trained to torture. So with that knowledge, with that method and that knowledge, the CIA then proceeded to propagate this method worldwide around the globe. And they did it through two ways. First of all, from about 1963 to 1974, they worked through a thing called Office of Public Safety. That was a hybrid CIA-USAID office that trained police officers worldwide. They trained about 1 million police officers in the Third World. And the CIA used that as a cover to pick out certain kinds of police officer for sophisticated training in torture. Then in 1974, Congress, in its first attempt to prohibit torture, discovered this torture training in Brazil, and they zeroed out, they destroyed OPS, Office of Policy Studies. And what they did then next was the CIA simply shifted its torture training to the U.S. Army. And they worked through the U.S. Army's Intelligence Command, and they worked through mobile training teams and School of Americas in Latin America. And from 1975 to 1990, they did the training through the Army.
We've been listening to Professor Alfred W. McCoy, the author of an amazing book, A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror.
Thank you, Professor. It's really it's just terrific to know that you're there and you're doing what people like Harvey Goldberg and William A. Williams and George Mossy and Fred Harvey Harrington did, and you're carrying on in that tradition, and it's just terrific to know you're there and you're doing this kind of work. Thank you very much for what you do.
Michael Smith, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Law and Disorder was produced by Jeff Brady. We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
Accomplished.